Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Magdalena Clough. Tonight, we continue our reading of A Key to Treehouse Living by Elliot Reed. The novel is written in the form of a glossary-style list, which our protagonist, William, compiles as a way to understand the world around him. Now, here's Trevor Rao, reading A Key to Treehouse Living.
Night Rat. A blind white rat that crosses the river at night and boards whatever floating object it encounters as it swims. The night rat is a well-mannered rat who keeps himself clean. The night rat does not fear you. His life of navigating big rivers by night, see Navigating Big Rivers by Night, has given him a great deal of courage. You will know the night rat is coming when you hear his nails scraping along the plastic barrels of your raft. No one can say for sure why the night rat swims at night, why he is blind, or where he comes from, but I have seen one come in advance of a storm, the same way horses will run to the cover of cedars, or spring peepers will start to sing in the daytime. See Ominous. The night rat is not to be feared, though his midnight appearance will come as a surprise. If you're lonely, you will come to appreciate him. Once the initial shock has passed, after his white fur is dried, you may even wish to stroke his coat, which he will not object to, provided you do it gently. He may show interest in the contents of your cooler. The night rat may even lift the lid of your cooler before your eyes, enter it, and begin to quietly nibble on one of the donuts you pulled from a dumpster. Sadly, the night rat has business on the banks, and will never float with you for long. Navigating Big Rivers by Night. At the first sign of dusk, the squeaking of a bat, the disappearance of swifts beneath bridges, paddle out to the middle of the river. If you're in the middle of the river, you're safer than you are on the shore, as long as you keep an eye out for barges. You'll see the light from people doing whatever they do at night on the banks of the river, and sometimes you'll even hear them. And when you do, you'll be glad you're out there on the water alone. Oceans. Judging by its surface, the ocean looks like everything a mating pond is not. And on the surface, it's true. But just below the ocean's surface, things are mating in great numbers. On the surface, the ocean looks open and infinite. But it can't be infinite because it has a center point. A point that is farthest from land and closest to the moon. Here, in the middle of the ocean, nothing is going anywhere. And everything is spinning in place. The wind, the waves, the wandering thunderclouds, see booms, the stars, everything is spinning up the next hurricane. Here's a trick El Hondero taught me, a way he taught me to use the ocean as a tool even when you're very far from it. If ever you can't sleep, or you're anxious, or you're alone somewhere with no idea what you should do next, close your eyes and picture yourself floating on your back in the middle of the ocean. You look up and the stars are slowly spinning in the night sky. Or you are the one spinning on the surface of the water. Feel the cool water below you. Taste the salt that laps up the side of your face. Then allow yourself to sink beneath the water, straight down, but don't stop looking up. Look up at the rippling surface of the sea as waves journey across it. Feel the void beneath you, but don't look down. Always up at the shining surface. And before you know it, you'll be asleep. Ordinary necessities of river-going rafters. You will need to use your pole to push off whatever rock or muddy shoal you get lodged upon. You will need to paddle away from large barges that are heading toward you on a collision course. You will need to maintain a low profile. You maintain a low profile while rafting down a river by traveling at night, in the fog, or if the stretch of river is remote enough, simply by keeping a lookout for anyone going up or down the river, who might try to ruin your plan. See Daddies. You will need to find food. This need you will address with whatever fishing gear you have aboard. If it comes down to it, you can beach your raft and head out on foot. Edible mushrooms and the fine, potato-like tuber called Jerusalem artichoke grow on the banks of rivers. Beyond the banks of rivers are roads, and along roads you can find places to buy or steal a snack. People say you can't drink the river water, but you can actually drink it if it's fresh, and you give it a minute to separate in a jar. Don't drink the mud at the bottom. If you need to sleep, it's best to pull several blankets over your head so that you completely shut out the outside world. It's hard to sleep if you're hearing the bubbles that come from unknown things in the deep murk below your raft. It's hard to sleep if you're scanning the bank for signs of daddies with flashlights who might also be yelling at you some things you don't want to hear. While it is true that shutting out the world while floating upon a river can be dangerous, telling yourself you're on a raft made so simply it's basically unsinkable will help put you at ease. The worst case scenario is you're getting sucked beneath a barge traveling upstream with 1,000 tons of coal. Your raft might pop back up somewhere downstream, but you won't be on it. Oarman. A man who rows his boat with oars. Pirates, when coming ashore, do so in rowboats full of muscled oarmen. Pirates don't paddle, and they don't pull rafts down rivers. They row. Another famous oarman is the one whose name I've forgotten. The one who paddled dead Greeks across the River Styx. Solitary oarmen rowing boats across rivers at night strike fear in the heart of a lone traveler, especially when the oarman who paddles his boat facing away from where he's heading is heading toward you. If the night is dead quiet and you're floating slowly downriver on a raft by yourself, there's a rolling fog on the water and a yellow full moon is coming up through the silhouettes of trees, and the oarman is coming toward you with his oil lamp, burning grease, you have no choice. You must find the courage to call out to him in a voice that is low but firm. Say, "Who goes there?" Pick up your headstone and wait to see what he does. You may hear the wooden thump of him knocking the oars and the gentle drops of water dripping from their ends. And he may turn to you, removing his oil lamp, and from the light of it, you will see his face. Ominous. If you say, "This doesn't look good," odds are it's because you've seen something ominous. An event that you know, through experience or intuition, precedes a second event that's bad for you. When someone says, "We need to talk," that's ominous. You hear a solitary oarman rowing his way toward you in the dead of night when you're alone and in a place where you've told nobody you're going. That's ominous. When you look up at the sky on a day in spring, let's say you're picking jelly beans from the grass and the sky has turned black, that's ominous. If you're someone who believes in signs, mystical visions, curses, destinies, ghosts, myths where people do things that no human should be able to do, then you're prone to seeing omens. Things that are ominous. When Hanging Frog saw a coyote climb a tree, he told everyone in the village to build an extra canoe. A few months later, a big flood came. That coyote was an omen because Hanging Frog made it one. Sometimes, an omen will come to you in a dream, and should cause you to change how you act when you're awake. Overboard, going. What has gone from being in a boat to being in the water has gone overboard. Maybe the saying comes from when all boats were made of wooden boards, and anything thrown from the boat into water must first have traveled over a board. For people on boats, unplanned trips overboard are almost always undesirable. To say going overboard can also mean to do too much of something. My uncle went overboard with his gambling. El Ondero went overboard with his drinking on the day he lost those weather balloons. I may have gone overboard the time I put a snapping turtle in Ernesto's bunk. To say you've gone overboard with your lists, your catalogs, and your keys, a little handbook would suffice, is to say that some authority has put a limit to the amount of time a person should spend thinking about the language of his life. Overcome by emotion. Bottom of the ninth, two outs, bases loaded. Home team down by three, full count. Little Ned steps into the box to take another pitch. Gets his bat up. The hopes and dreams of 12 boys depend on him. Three watch from the bases, sweat stinging their eyes beneath plastic helmets. Eight more lean their heads out of the dugout, hawking the sweet spit of chewing gum. Some praying aloud, some silently. Some boys are muttering beneath their breath and wringing their hands. When Ned brings his bat up, the other boys take a breath and hold it. The coaches, who have taught Ned to hold his bat this way, who've shown him how to run through first base and how to spot a hole in the outfield, are even more on edge than the players. The coaches are superstitious. They see omens and have many little rituals that they use to keep their composure under stress. The coach's own boys are on this team, and each coach would rather it be his own boy at that plate right now. But it is what it is, and Ned's the one to swing. And it's clear to the coaches that he doesn't stand a chance. Ned's late in the lineup. He swings at everything. When he runs, if he runs like he's hurting. He's at this game because the team brought him here, not the other way around. He plays in deep right when they're fielding, and has on numerous occasions been caught sitting Indian style, picking grass. He strolls toward fly balls, he gets called a lot of names, and has vowed to himself that this will be his last baseball season forever. Ned tightens the grip on his bat. The pitcher winds up. Moments of truth this caliber come just 3 times in a person's life. 5 times if you're lucky. Ned knows he has to try this time. He needs to regain the feeling he had at the beginning of the season, back when the Cardinal's hat his father gave him was clean and stiff, before the other boys stole it and ground it into the infield dirt, before the ball took a bad hop and knocked his braces out of whack and he sat down in the grass and cried. Back before all that, when he still had faith in the game. This time he needs to try, if not just for the simple fact that his mother is in the stands, there beside his father, clapping and saying his name. She doesn't know how bad a player he is, and if she did, she wouldn't care. The pitcher throws. The ball seems to move slowly through the crepuscular light. Past the outfield fence, a boy is straddling his bike. Ned notices this boy as the pitcher releases the ball, and is half looking at the ball and half looking at the lone boy past the outfield, when he finds himself swinging. And this time it's a firm, natural cut he takes. A cut that starts at his back foot, and then a hit that sends a shock through the bat and into his hands. A sharp whack that lands on the ears of the runners who run, wide-eyed in amazement, as the coaches drop their jaws as cans slip from the hands of spectators and tumble down the metal bleachers. Ned watches the ball rise and keep rising, rising past the left fielder, and the boy on his bike strains his head upward and shoots up his fist. Ned starts to trot toward first. The only thing he hears is his heart beating in his ears against the sides of his helmet. Then, up like hiccups, come his hysterical giggles. If he could hear, he would hear the 30 onlookers in the bleachers cheering for him, and his father, hat cast off and jumping up and down, screaming his name as Ned rounds third. His father shaking with sobs of joy by the time Ned touches home. Ned's mom has her hand on his father's shoulder. She's blushing. This man, crying in the Little League bleachers, is what you would call overcome by emotion. This same kind of emotion can overcome you in the depths of night, when you're alone and thinking of your best friend who you haven't seen since the fire because you're afraid that's where Patty would know to come looking for you. It can come as a dream. It can be fallacious. On the 9th night of my float down the river, the oarman paddled out to me, raised his light, and I saw that it was El Hondero. I took the rope he threw me and pulled us together. He'd come for me. He'd been planning this all along. He had something to tell me, and I tried to hear him, but I couldn't make out his words. He pointed downriver, and I looked, saw the tar-like water shining in the moonlight, saw the swells of low hills silhouetted by distant lights far beyond the banks, but nothing new. Everything was the same as it had been. When I looked back, he was gone. No lamp, no rowboat, no oarman. If you're overcome by emotion and you're alone, here's what you do. Don't try to do anything but this. Lie down, curl up, and let it wash over you. On the island. When traveling downriver, after a night in which you may or may not have encountered a ghost, you will want to stop on an island. Find a sandbar, beach your raft, and take a break from the float. Sometimes it can be hard to find an island because islands like to disguise themselves as riverbanks. If you stay in the main channel, it may seem like the river has no islands, when in fact there are islands all around. Some are barely more than mudhills with moats. Others are full-blown lands of hills and forests, caves and ponds, and all kinds of plants and animals. To find an island, you must paddle or pull along one of the banks, staying clear of rock jetties and low-hanging branches while keeping an eye on the river horizon. Look for where the river splits. When you see the split, that's the tip of an island. The best part about deciding to stop on an island is that what's on it is always a surprise. You may find a deep oak forest with soft, leafy ground and plenty of shade. You may climb up the muddy shelf and find not a forest, but a vast field of corn planted neatly in rows and a low, green hill way out there like an island in the corn. The hill, you'll think, is actually an Indian mound that escaped the plow. There are some ancient cedar trees at its foot, and a fallen down barbed wire fence that weaves its way among and through them. From the top of the mound, you can see the whole island. Once in a lifetime thing. You probably won't have a chance to do it again. This is the only time this thing is going to happen to you. You're sitting alone on your raft in the middle of a day, and a macaw comes and lands on your raft. A fluorescent bird, 1,000 miles from its natural habitat, lands on your raft, looks at you, squawks, and flaps off. Then there was this time I watched a family of river otters transfixed by a cloud of pale yellow butterflies. A once-in-a-lifetime opportunity is what El Hondero said the mica hunt in Ohio was. And of course he was lying, because in the end I didn't even get the one single chance. If you only have one chance to do it, at least think hard about whether or not you should. Another once-in-a-lifetime experience was the time I pulled up on the bank of the river just downstream from a huge factory. The factory was complete with skyscraping smokestacks with bright flashing lights on their tips so the airplanes wouldn't hit them in the night. When I arrived, it was twilight, just beyond the crepuscular. I needed a break. I was tired, bored, didn't think much about the risks, and figured the factory was as good a place to stop as any. People don't like to hang around near smokestacks, toxic runoff, and heavy-duty electrical equipment, and so there was not much chance I'd get caught. Chances of running into somebody right there on the bank where I'd docked, just upstream of a big culvert puking greenish water into the river, slim to none. Which is why I froze, stunned, when I came upon a little campfire where two fat ladies from Texas were grilling chicken thighs on spears. There was the huge factory looming over us, its high metal walkways and machine sounds deafening, belching smoke that smelled of rotten eggs. And then there was the smell of grilling chicken, and two big women from Texas who were having a little cookout. They invited me over and told me they were on a road trip, and asked if I was looking for a good time. They grilled me some chicken, and I ate it by the fire, thanked them, said I had to pee, and slipped off in my raft. I could see their shadows projected by the light of their campfire on one of the big metal walls of the factory. They were enormous. Opening negotiations with a daddy when he finds you washed ashore and partially drowned because your raft got sucked under a barge while you were sleeping. This is an impossibility. Best you can do is cry like the child you are and prepare to be hauled off to a middle-of-nowhere jailhouse. Operatic falsetto. A high-pitched, ear-piercing singing voice that is shouted with great intensity and emotion, traditionally from the stage, traditionally during an opera, but not always. You may come into contact with an operatic falsetto in other situations, and these situations can be terrifying. The worst part is that you never know if somebody is capable of the operatic falsetto just by looking at them. If the operatic falsetto belonged exclusively to very short men with very large chests, for example, you could be on your guard around those men. There's almost no way of being prepared for the moment when a man cuts loose with his operatic falsetto. The one way you can tell that your company possesses an operatic falsetto and intends to use it is the following. When the radio starts playing opera, he turns it up as high as it will go, closes his eyes, and begins to sway in his seat. If you see this, prepare yourself for the falsetto. If he then lifts a finger in the air and begins conducting, get the hell out of there as fast as you can. If you're confined to the back seat of a police cruiser and he's the sheriff in the front seat driving you God knows where through the night, and if he stops his car to turn up the opera and unleashes falsetto, you will very badly want to plug your ears, but you must not. Whatever you do, don't plug your ears, because it's most important of all, when dealing with daddies in the wilderness, that you not offend them. Bad things have happened to orphans who have. Just look at the missing person flyers on the corkboard outside your local supermarket. Odds are that some of those missing orphans offended a certain operatic falsetic sheriff who once picked them up where they'd washed up on the banks of a river. Occupants of holding areas in rural jails. If you are caught by an authority figure who was called by a couple of catfishermen who found you hacking up river water on the banks after your raft got sucked beneath a coal barge, he will put you in his cop car and take you wherever he wants. If you've got no identification or money or worthwhile possessions on you and look more pathetic than threatening, he will take you to a holding area while he tries to figure out what to do with you. In the holding area is a TV in a cage high up on the wall, three stained couches, two lazy boy chairs that are bolted to the ground, a pink plastic card table with four plastic chairs, a deck with 49 cards, some reference handouts for drug addicts and some for people who want to be religious, a toilet with no stall around it, and a collection of Hardy Boys mysteries in paperback. You will not be alone in the holding area. The holding area will contain neighbors who, at first, are not happy to see you. Occupants of holding cells will vary from jail to jail, and they will represent the poorest people in that jail's area. For instance, if you're taken to a jail in what turns out to be rural Louisiana, your neighbors will be a young diesel mechanic named Big T, who talks too fast and whose accent is too thick for you to understand, and a quiet, pudgy guy with a ponytail who reeks of alcohol and has skin like paste, whose balding head above the ponytail flakes like wax, and who has an enormous tattoo of a betta fish on his neck. The neighbors of your holding area will be glued to the television, which, in its iron cage, is broadcasting reruns of the TV show Cops. If you interrupt him as he's trying to watch Cops to ask about the betta fish on his neck, an occupant of a holding area in a rural jail cell will say, in a way that actually sounds friendly, that he'll tell you what the betta fish means if you let him give you a black eye. And then you'll have to decide if it's worth it. Porking. If when you come home early, you walk in on your fiancé and a man you don't know having sex in the kitchen of your house, you've found them porking. If you come home and find that a stranger is porking your fiancé in the kitchen of your house, you'll become angry. See mortal betrayal. And lose control of yourself. See overboard, going. Most often, the porker will run off into the woods after you hit him with a chair and tell him to get out. And an hour after, you and your fiancé will be trying to get back on good terms again. If the porker is a lawyer, on the other hand, and you hit him with a chair and he runs off into the woods, just as you and your fiancé are making up, the sheriff will show up and take you to the holding area. Once you're there, you'll want to make yourself feel better about the whole episode by telling the strangers who are in the holding area with you all about what happened. Peaceful neutrality. If you're new to a holding area, chances are you won't be receiving a warm welcome from your new neighbors. Over time, if you're polite, see good manners, the importance of, your neighbors may seem to get used to your presence. Once this period of adjustment has passed, you'll be asked to take sides. The occasion of your choosing a side will involve a conflict among your neighbors in the holding cell. If, say, one guy wants to switch the channel because he's been watching nothing but Cops reruns for days, and, say, the other guy would rather watch Cops than the only other available channel, which is showing vintage Looney Tunes, and he says, "Elmer Fudd ain't funny," you may be asked to cast a tie-breaking vote. It is important that you not voice an opinion, even if you have one, since voicing an opinion will make a friend of one of the men but a mortal enemy of the other, and, in this case, subscribing to one team and not to the other will officially make you part of whatever game or competition or conflict that may arise in the rest of your time in the holding cell. Pissing your pants. This is a phrase that is used to describe a state of extreme fear. Let's say you're sharing a holding area with two men who are much larger than you, whose speech you find hard to understand, and whose violent outbursts come mostly at random. These are men you've just met, whom you know nothing about, who've committed any number of strange, elaborate, twisted crimes in recent nights before eventually winding up locked in here with you. They wind up here so often that it's like a living room for them. They know how to fix the broken television so it works, and they know which of the tables isn't bolted to the floor of the holding area, and they've even hidden cigarettes in a Bible with a hollow place in it that's one of the only books on the little shelf. Let's say that the appearance of Elmer Fudd on a television screen in that holding area causes a man with waxy skin and a tattoo on his neck to beat another man in the holding area with a plastic card table. Let's say you've abandoned peaceful neutrality to intervene in the conflict and are subsequently threatened with the plastic table. You might, at that point, be pissing your pants. Patrols at night. The job of someone who patrols at night is to keep an eye on a place between dusk and dawn, when people should be sleeping and nothing should require attention, but when most evil things usually happen. The night patrol checks to see that all the locks are still locked, that the drips dripping from the air conditioners haven't overfilled the cups that catch them. He checks to see that the vending machine is stocked, and that all the pencils in a cup on the lieutenant's desk are sharp. At any moment in the night, he might be called out to a blood-covered living room in a nearby trailer and asked to make photographs of dead people. He walks past the holding room and looks inside. He's supposed to do this every couple of hours. The night patrol must be cool-headed but firm, and, in principle, he must uphold the rules of the institution he patrols. Between patrols, he can be found reading a book or listening to the radio at a desk down the hall from the holding area. If he's like the night patrol at the jail whose holding area you've occupied for 36 hours after having washed ashore on the banks of a river, who finds you huddled in a corner of the holding area during the course of his patrol, he'll take you from that holding area, give you a soda and a candy bar from the vending machine, and ask you to tell him your story. If you tell your story right, he'll make some notes on papers, lean in to show he's listening, and once you're done telling your story, he'll tell you his. It'll be late, and you'll be exhausted, and it might be boring to hear him talk about his job, but you must try to stay awake. It's bad manners to fall asleep when people are talking to you. When he's done talking, he'll let you take a shower in the employee locker room, and then, just before dawn, he'll give you a ride to the nearest bus station, where he'll instruct you to wait for the afternoon bus going north. In the idling car, he'll hand you a little garbage bag in which you'll find another garbage bag, the one you thought you'd lost in the shipwreck. And inside that bag, you'll find your papers, the photograph of your dad, and the arrowhead you picked up on the island upriver. He'll apologize on behalf of the operatic falsetic sheriff, and he'll thank you for listening to him talk for a while. And then he'll leave. You often find lonely people in the most unlikely places. Podunk Town. On the surface, in the eyes of a visitor, a podunk town has no distinguishing characteristics. In reality, every podunk town has its own set of laws, rules, guidelines, and specialized terms. Nearly all podunk towns have a dollar store, a McDonald's, a car repair shop, a religious antique store, a bus stop, and a gas station. In most podunk towns, one or two people will be sitting up against a dumpster in the gas station parking lot drinking a beer from 40-ounce glass bottles. The sidewalks of a podunk town are mostly empty. Cars can be seen idling in the dollar store parking lot and in lines at the drive-thru. Killing time in a podunk town can be a chore if all you have is a few dollars and a bus ticket. The first thing to do is check the dollar store dumpster for stationery supplies and expired snacks. Avoid the locals as you do this. If the podunk town you're in is the home of the sheriff who has recently arrested you on unfounded charges of trespassing, theft, and conspiracy to burglarize, be especially careful not to attract attention to yourself. Scan the ground for dropped money or bills that have been sucked by wind from cars idling at the drive-thru. The bushes around the drive-thrus often contain bills in their thorns. If, when you check the bushes, you find 10 bucks and you're bored and depressed because your raft was sucked beneath a barge, it's a good idea to approach the two men by the dumpster with your money and have them buy you one of those big beers. Maybe one of them is in real estate. You must hope that neither of these men is a daddy. Be careful that they give you enough change when they give you your bottle of beer, but don't count it in front of them because it's rude to act like they're not trustworthy, and then tip them a dollar for their efforts. When they ask you where you're going, say Paducah, unless, of course, you are actually going to Paducah, in which case tell them Poughkeepsie. If you're lucky, whatever podunk town you get stuck in will also be near a river and a bridge, or at least a culvert where you can go to get out of the sun for a while.
You have been listening to A Key to Treehouse Living, a novel by Elliot Reed, read by Trevor Rao. This episode of The Bookshelf was produced by Chris Massini and me, Magdalena Clough. Music by Dr. Turtle. Executive producer is Vern Windham. You can find this and other past episodes of The Bookshelf online at SpokanePublicRadio.org.